Hey guys, I'm really happy to have back on the channel, thanks to popular demand as well, the founder of Gold, Goats, and Guns. I always have to think a couple of times to get the three G's right in the right order, but it's great to have you back. Tom Luongo, how are you doing?
I am excellent, Francis. Thank you very much for the invite. I appreciate it.
Absolute pleasure. Delighted to have you back. It was a great discussion last time. I'm going to flash a couple of charts through the process of this so that we it's great having discussions, but people also, I get the feeling that we've got to do a little bit more. What do they do? Tie it to the asset. Is it up? Is it down? Am I a buyer? Am I a seller? Et cetera, et cetera. So they come away with a little bit of investment strategy as well out of a great conversation. The first one I'm going to show you, Tom, is in fact going to be one I don't think you're going to have any bother talking in some detail about, and that is the debt market. So let's get that share up. I'm going to bring up your very homegrown and super special debt market, the US 30-year, and let's have a look at how that one's been going recently. And yeah, first your comments on the charts, if it's showing there nice and clearly, hopefully for you.
I can see it.
Before you answer, I framed it, and let's get the framing right. Since the March 2020 event, which was our call for the end of the bond bull, so I'm moving it around there for a little bit. Give us your comment from there on onwards.
Sure. So I don't know if you can. You probably can't see my cursor, but you know, when I look at this, we did have a peak coming into the. The bond bull market is over, and I expected that because I remember from the moment you and I first started talking, Francis, I've been of the opinion that the Fed was going to go to 6%. And I also thought that the idea that the yield curve inversion that existed, on the U.S. debt markets, was way overdone. I didn't believe it at all. At a certain point, the markets had to finally kind of believe that Jerome Powell was serious, that he wasn't going to pivot and go back to the zero bound. And I think it took until about March of this year when he raised rates in the middle of a banking crisis to finally get everybody to go, oh, no, he's serious. And at that point, we hit a change in the psychology of the bond market. And since the rest of the world is still doing a form of yield curve control, especially the ECB and obviously the BOJ, the Bank of Japan, at some point, people have to like get real with this, the potential for a return of inflation. And if you remember at the beginning of the year, I made a call saying, look, oil is going to be weak for the first half of the year, and then we're going to get a rally in oil in the second half of the year. Once China opens up, back up, and you know, a variety of other things happen, we get past the Biden administration stops draining the Strategic Petroleum Reserve and all the rest of it. And since most of the inflation we're dealing with is a commodity cost push inflation, not a demand pull inflation, interest rates are not really, you know, tied to the inflation cycle, even though that's the rhetoric, right? That's been my argument, my thesis now for 2 years. And so no shock that, you know, once we get past the reaction of, oh my God, we have to, the U.S. banking system is breaking down and banks are failing and people do a safe haven rush into U.S. treasuries, that once that impulse was done and the U.S. markets didn't break apart and the banking crisis didn't metastasize, we were going to have a normalization of the long end of the yield curve. And that's exactly what we've seen. And I felt that even when the 210 spread was trading at, you know, negative 110 basis points, I said, this is unsustainable. And because of that, you know, it's just been kind of playing out exactly the way I kind of expected. And even when I had Danielle Booth on my podcast and we were chatting about it in June, I asked her about this. She said, there's no way that's going to happen. And I said, okay, well, we'll see what happens. And now we're at negative, well, we're at about a 16 basis point inversion on the 210 spread as opposed to a negative 100 basis point. And so I'm not surprised at all to see the 30 continue to rise. The 10-30 spread, the extreme long end of the spread, has been positive for months, actually since that time. The short end of the curve normalized out to 6 months, and it's really been the belly of the yield curve that's been the worst. But even that has gotten incredibly shallow. The whole inversion has shallowed and normalized tremendously. And now we're even seeing from like the 5.7, even the 5.10, and then the 10.30, they're all kind of weakly positive at this point. And so it's now just the 1 year, 2 year, and 3 year portion of the curve that's deeply inverted. And that's what has to that's the next part of the process to get over the psychological hump. Okay.
Let me jump in there a bit, because you've actually taken to a second chart. Grab us a drag on that cigar, because what you Tom started for everybody watching and started to refer to is the yield curve inversion elements. So not only was he discussing the fact that we both called for the 30-year and the 10-year to run to new highs, and that everybody is not, the one moment that the Fed is not lying is on the longer for higher bit. Generally, otherwise, I've taken everything they've said with a pinch of salt. And when we look at the 10 and 2s, which is a popular one, so this is, means for everybody's understanding, the U.S. 10-year yield, having subtracted from it the yield that is on the U.S. 2-year debt instrument. This actually is the chart, Tom. And I thought maybe for some fun, you'd enjoy also talking, side introduce it, that the worst moment, the big drama, is actually the reversion back into the normal zone, which is out of the negative zone. And we delved over here. We're in the bottom right corner, the current reality, but I gave a big world view. We went well below 1% negative on the 10s and 2s. And we're now at 0.17, and we've had 1, 2, 3, and this is the fourth and the longest candle heading back up to what I call the beginning of the demand destroying event will now be imminent at some point, which is the blue line, the zero line back into the zone. And I've highlighted all the previous crises. What's your take? Where do you, you know, what would you add on yield curve inversions, and how would you like to pitch it to those that are watching us?
Well, I think that, you know, the way I look at it, and I betray my bias here, of course, because I'm an American, right? So I don't want to see the United States destroyed. I want to see the Federal Reserve act in the best interest of the United States. I think that that's exactly what they've been doing by raising interest rates as hard and as fast as they have. I understand that they need to do that in order to defend themselves, because it had gotten to the point with, after over a decade at the zero bound, that the Eurodollar markets, the offshore dollar markets, have so thoroughly swamped the domestic concerns of, you know, of the American banking system and the American economy, and had so thoroughly perverted it, that we need to get back to a normal situation. And so for me, I look at the 210 spread normalizing, and I say, oh, look, all of a sudden banks can start properly, you know, lending, buying, you know, going short and lending long, right? They can do their classic, the mortgage markets will actually make, the mortgage rates will actually make sense, and the banks can be profitable, you know, borrowing from the Fed at 2 and lending out 10. And this is, I think, what the process that has to happen if the Fed wants to survive this period of history, right? And in any current form, and maybe even GASP, go back to more of its original charter, which is not to be the entire economy, but to go back to being a lender of last resort from a regional perspective, like it was originally intended. And then that's what I think is going on here. And I think Powell has invited this normalization of the yield curve. And it's being fought desperately by those who cannot handle having rates in U.S. rates go higher, and then how that impacts globally around the world in terms of everybody else's rates. And so we're seeing, you know, yield curve control, extreme levels of yield curve control from Christine Lagarde over at the ECB, for example, trying to hold the German 10-year. Yeah, the Japanese. Well, I think the Japanese are trying to do it by degrees, right? I think Ueda's, you know, he's trying to exit this policy as well, similar to Powell. But it's Lagarde who absolutely doesn't want it. And she makes this abundantly clear. And you can see it's really, you want to look at a chart, put up the weekly chart of the German 10-year. Francis, yeah. And you'll see exactly what I'm talking about. And I've been chronicling this for my subscribers on almost a weekly basis for over a year now, saying, you know, she's holding the German 10-year for forever below 2.5%. She's failed. the French 10-year below 3, the Italian 10-year below 4.25, the Dutch 10-year below 3. I mean, it's just, but it all stems from trying to hold the U.S. 10-year down. And they've done that by buying an unbelievable amount of U.S. treasuries, as reported on the Treasury Internet FDIC report. If you break it down by region, the ECB and its proxies have bought nearly $600 billion of U.S. treasuries since September of 2021, when the Fed started tightening. Because remember, the Fed started tightening when it raised the reverse repo rate above the Fed funds rate and started draining the world of dollars, right? Before it actually started raising the Fed funds rate, it raised the reverse repo rate and created a $2.5 trillion slush fund. That was all what I would call M0 draining of the global market. And you can see how the ECB and the BOJ and not the BOJ, the BOE, and the Bank of England and others have all been just buying an unbelievable amount of U.S. treasuries to hold this yield curve inversion in place for as long as they can. And the candles you just showed on the 210 spread show you that they're losing control of that market, that policy has run out of money, basically, in a kind of Margaret Thatcher sense.
The other interesting part that many people seem to forget, that they talk about interest rates and interest rates rising, what they tend not to think is that they just should look at the ulterior motive of that. It's about devaluing a overvalued debt Ponzi. Rate rises. It's actually nothing to do with the economy being in amazing shape and being far too sizzly hot and wages being too high and too many high-paying jobs being doubled. It's absolutely nothing to do with that. They're trying to taper the hypervaluation of debt markets. So it's actually crashing. They're trying to land a lead Zeppelin balloon, essentially, softly, that has to be landed at a time that tax receipts are tanking, costs are escalating, both on interest payments now matching and surpassing debt, and at the same time, they're having to issue more debt than they've ever done before, and they want to try crash land this thing. And there's no easy way. You've had a 40-year escalator, and I can't see it taking much longer than four or five years, and it's got to be the escalator. It's got to be the elevator down, you know, with a snap cable in terms of trying to deflate this. And that's what I get a feeling that most people are not appreciating. We're looking at a hyperbolic issuance matter. We're looking at a lot, the curve shortens in terms of issuance. It's got shorter. If those debt needs rolling over again, we're just looking, as far as the eye can see, there is this product that supposedly is incredibly valuable, but it's proliferated on an umpteenth degree, which is the difference between scarcity typically being associated with value. Talk to me about that aspect of it. I mean, surely, and it's always spoken about as yields and rates need to go up and inflation. It's actually trying to land a debt bomb, isn't it? Surely,
I'll agree, Francis. I've no argument here. This is the problem. As Martin Armstrong likes to put it, we're at a 5,000-year low in interest rates. Do you really think we're not gonna get a mean reversion at some point, right? Like that, something has to happen. What that means is that we have a fundamental shift in market psychology away from debt as an asset to tangible assets. So from intangible assets, debt and credit-based assets, to tangible assets. And that's what we're starting to see. This is why there's a bid under the price of oil, because oil ultimately is the collateral for all this debt, because that's the means by which we create value with which we can service the debt, right? So,
Well, we're getting things like softs that haven't moved in ages, making new highs, cocoa, sugar, everything. And these things just got productized, technified, ever bigger farms run on lesser people that really got super efficient on these elements. And as you're pointing out, the commodity boom is starting to get a little bit of traction. But it's about, we've gone from search for yield, the Jim Grant story of the age gone by, to capital preservation, surely, as well, which is why the physical commodities.
Agreed. Like, it's the return of your money, not the return on your money. Right, as Mark Fabry put it all those years ago, that's where I first learned that phrase. Right, And
great phrase.
Yeah. And that's going to be this period, and rates have to normalize to back to something, you know, approximating the real risk of investment. I also, you know, look at it from a, you know, a kind of classic Austrian business cycle perspective of saying, okay, we have to price risk properly so that we can figure out where the, what capital we have in the pool of real savings, however small or large that is, has to be directed to where it's going to create the highest rate of return. And what have we done over the last 15 years with zero bound rates? We've starved commodity production of its profit making potential. Like, you've got silver producers who are on, you know, on profit drip feeds with, you know, with all in sustaining cash costs of $20 an ounce, and silver trading at $22 an ounce. How are they supposed to make any money? Obviously they're not. And it's almost kind of like this colonial extraction model, you know, as that's what zero bound interest rates did for an entire generation, nearly a generation. And now Powell seems to be, you know, purposefully blowing that up and saying credit asset prices need to come down and commodity asset prices need to come up, and we need to have a meeting in the middle, I think, of where we're going to wind up with. So as much as I love gold, I'm not one of these guys who will tell you that gold's going to go to $85,000 an ounce. Like, I don't buy that. What I buy is that we're in a negotiation period of how far we're going to allow credit assets like housing and cars and all this other stuff come down, commercial real estate, and how much we're going to allow commodity prices to come up. And there's going to be a meeting in the middle. And so I can see $7,000-$8,000 on gold, for example. It could be anywhere from $5,000 to $20,000, depending on what they want to do. But there's going to be this intensive period of negotiation. And until we get a normalization of yields, or at least the beginning of the normalization of yields, we can't allow.
But the other point to that is we can't afford a normalization of yields. And this brings in the reset discussion, that this whole process is never going to complete. It's going to get truncated by events of some form. And that will then be the headline behind that yield curve reversion story that was subprime.com. We'll get, you know, we'll name it. It'll have a bank, or it'll be a Russian hack, or it'll be whatever. But there are going to be geopolitically based events that are going to be designed, A, to distract us. They might be financial, but they could be totally different. We've just seen an escalation, as you're aware, already. So are you of the mind that they ever get to that eventuality? Do you think there will be no hard reset that's enforced on us? Because a lot of this is, we can't settle all this debt. It's too vast. It's too big. There's quadrillions of derivatives based on it. We end up doing, that's the crap of the old home. We're locking it up. We're burning it down. We're starting on a clean piece of paper. There's a bottleneck. Some of the assets go through. Some of the others don't. We leave that all behind. That's where your pension gets destroyed, or my pension, the government's pensions. They say, hey, guys, sorry. Guess what? You know, all the debt's kind of worthless because of this event, which they'll then call a black swan, which it clearly won't be. And then we go through this, the narrative forming that Greenspan tried to give us in the run-up to the subprime crisis, you know, how he said it was a black swan event, and all of this narrative forming that basically absolves him of all guilt in terms of a financialization of everything era, where everything got maxed out, and of course prices went crazy as a result of ridiculous lending policies. Or do you think they'll land this Zeppelin?
Oh, I don't know that they'll land the Zeppelin. Okay. I just know that the path that we've taken so far is the right one, because what we're starting to see are the right responses politically. So weaker fight on Capitol Hill, leaving Mike Johnson in place as opposed to Kevin McCarthy, that's a beginning of the healing process, because now everybody has to look at this and go, yeah, we can't afford this. What they always tell you what they want to do. George Soros has told us exactly what they want to do for years, which is they know they can't pay the debts back. They don't want to pay the debts back. They want to default on the debt. Christine Lagarde came out this morning. You and I are doing this on what? On the 27th of the Friday, 27th of October. She came out this morning and said, it's time for us to fiscally come together, or you know, now is the time. And I went, oh, really? So things suck, and now give us more power so we can make things suck more. Because what do they want to do? They want to consolidate all the debts in Europe under the ECB, and then do a perpetual debt swap, default on $14 trillion or whatever it is of European sovereign debt, and issue perpetual bonds at, I don't know, 0.5% or whatever, and try and then give us a digital euro and or give the people of Europe a digital euro and come out with a clean balance sheet. That's what they want to do. And a lot of the rest of the world is saying no. And that's where I see this at this point. So I'm hoping that this is that I'm not getting lost here.
No, not at all. We had a small dip, just so that you know, and I just turned my camera off to avoid throttling the upload.
Yeah, it's always dodgy with me. I don't have the greatest of internet service, right? So I just, sure. I'm always a little sensitive to that. So, you know, the other side of this is the same thing on Capitol Hill. We can't afford $2 trillion deficits. We can't afford to continue to do these things. Powell wants to hold interest rates as high as possible for as long as possible before he has to cut and then bring, you know, and he's going to cut. I mean, I know he's going to cut. I just think he's going to get the 6% before he cuts, and then he wants to be able to cut back to 4.5%. As opposed to stop at 3.5% and go back to 2% or whatever. He wants to go from 6% back to 4.5%, and that's how he thinks he's going to land the Zeppelin, right?
Yeah.
And then, you know, let the chips fall where they may. Whereas the problem with that is, of course, that is going to crush all the other Ponzi schemes that are based on the debt, on the Fed's Ponzi scheme. What the way I put it to in an article, probably a year and a half ago, I said, look, yeah, you can't taper a Ponzi scheme, but you can if you're the biggest Ponzi scheme and there are smaller Ponzis that you can hoover up and delay the day of reckoning for you while you eat up everybody else. And I look at the Fed as the world's largest Ponzi scheme. And so if the Fed decides to defend itself, it can do so. It's going to eat all the other Ponzis first. And since at this point, the euro dollar markets and the European debt markets and what they have said they want to do, you have to view them as the Fed's ultimate enemy, because what they want to do is do away with commercial banking. They want to do away with the private formation of capital. They want a central bank digital currency. They want a single zone, a single loop monetary system between the central bank and the borrower with no commercial banks in the middle. As far as I'm concerned, that's communism. So the Fed, of course, being the people who answer to ultimately to the New York banking cartel, because that's who owns the Fed, right? Well, that's the Fed's job, is to serve the commercial banking interests of the United States. So I don't see the U.S. commercial banks going that way. I mean, it's just been saying this, the same talking point, and you're just seeing it play itself out over and over and over again.
Do you not see this possibly as the Fed's going to front run on the interest rates tightening cycle? And we saw this with Britain and the pensions. I saw this as a test, because the British Bank of England only did a 0.25 when the US, or a half when the US did a 0.75. I can't remember the details. I might be murky on this, but they did a lesser increase. And there was a divergence in the interest rate purchasing power parity, the interest rate parity, whatever you want to consider it at. And suddenly you had a run on the pound. You had the pension markets not be able to sell their bonds. There was no bid, insufficient bid, because they weren't getting the yield they needed. So they actually had to dispose of some of their bond holdings to make up the shortfall for pension payments. And they couldn't sell. There wasn't a sufficient bid. They put an offer up there and they would have crashed the market. And they were all caught out of hand. And they ended up throwing a prime minister and a chancellor under the bus for that. But in actual fact, for me, it was a central banking error. They said, well, they did a growth budget, you know, they cut taxes, and they you know, said, we'll run a deficit, a bigger deficit. We try to stimulate the economy, which actually, funny enough, although I didn't like either of the characters involved, was probably the right thing to do in the difficult circumstances. To load up the taxes was a terrible idea. They were doing the opposite. Not increasing taxation and trying to the business friendly stimulating thing. But they got thrown under the bus for that. Oh, you'll create deficits. That's why it happened. But in actual fact, they were scapegoated by the central banks are far more powerful than the talking head teleprompter reader. So they were expendable. But I get the feeling that this is how it brings us. You mentioned Brent Johnson's milkshake theory, that by defending the dollar and also by being the more aggressive on devaluing the debt, which is the raising of the interest rates. They don't actually really want to raise the interest rates on the citizens, but they do want to devalue to be the one that is writing down the debt fastest, which means they are writing off debt. So they're raising the rates and they stay out the front, which then keeps the dollar. They almost all the central banks are now in a race, because if the others don't keep up with the peloton, it's like the cycling race. I've got to stay up with you, Tom, because if I'm not slipstreaming on your back and you're going really fast and staying right on your back wheel and I fall back, I'm gone. You're gone. And then I've got to break the airflow myself, you know. So you've got to stay on your front runner, your mark, who's setting the pace setter. And inherently, they're all now really realizing the situation simultaneously and are all now in a death knell where they were. We once had the dash to the bottom. And we're now having the dash to rush rates up, because the minute somebody blinks and thinks, well, that's a bit hard, it's killing the citizens, poor citizens, and starts thinking anywhere in that sense, bang, you're off. Your currency will go down, because this turns into a currency war as well. It's still a currency war, all of this, because the debt is borrowed. It. So one of the aspects that people don't see, they always go, debt markets are boring. This is super interesting. Because it's your currency market, it's your trade deficits, it's everything. This is macroeconomics. And in actual fact, it's a currency war to be raising rates and writing down your debt. It is a currency war. And if you do not march at the same rate as everyone in the peloton is marching, you fall out the back and you get destroyed. And then you're needing dollars to pay back on your dollar-denominated debt if you're anywhere else but in the euros dollar field. And that's going to be going to lead to a steady increase in the value of dollar. So I see the dollar going up in spite of it being the biggest Ponzi first. And that's the wrecking ball that slowly the others can't keep going up any higher. I mean, and something breaks. That's why I see it. Something breaks. It's a game of chicken now and something else breaks. They realize they're tied together. They've got to run. And if you're running in the wet at night and I'm chained to you, I've got to run after you at the same rate in the wet, barefoot at night until one of us, you know, falls over properly for a rock, a stone, or a cliff, or something else. How do you think of that?
I'm sitting here just smiling. I'm just sitting here smiling, Francis, because you just took all my talking points. All I'm going to say is the following: listen to where we are with the Jay Powell Lagarde. Powell raises rates in September by 25 basis points. Lagarde raises. He says, hey, I'm leaving myself open to raise more. And she says, this will be the last rate. The way I've been putting it is that Powell is actually the first bond vigilante, the real bond vigilante. Like the central banks have been running the bond vigilantes out of the market for 50 years. They never emerged as an asset class or as an investor class of any work, because there was always room to cut, because it was balance sheet room to put all the debt on the national balance sheets. And then once we run out of balance sheet room, now all of a sudden it's going to be, who's going to be the first bond vigilante and call the bluff of everybody else's monetary policy? And clearly it was Jerome Powell. He's forced Lagarde higher. She then turns around, has to try play games maintaining credit spreads, which is what she did when, you know, at the July 2022 meeting, where she introduced the idea of the TPI, known as the Transmission Protection Instrument. I like to call it the Toilet Paper Initiative, because that's what it's going to turn the euro into, right? And so Powell leaves himself optionality to raise or not raise, and, you know, basically keeps saying to Lagarde, balls in your court. Your inflation is still at negative. Your rates are still at negative 3% real yield. I'm at positive 2% or 2.5% based on the CPI, even though the CPI is nonsense, but it doesn't matter. It's what we all...
Yeah, least ugly, yeah.
So she's stuck. Meanwhile, at the BOJ, Ueda is trying to slowly unwind his problem, right? And he's doing so, you know, by degrees, fits and
stuff. 1.5% half market.
He's going to have to let it run.
Gentlemen, by the way, on their tenure, sorry to speak over you, we've got a 1.7% target as next, and it's about 7.8 at the moment.
On the Japanese tenure?
Next leg up as part.
Yeah, I agree with that completely.
That's going to be coming, new ones. And people would have said at 0.25, We predicted a 0.75, and they said it's not going to happen. It's happened, and now we are at a 1.7. We're saying he's going to run 1.7. It's a weird number. It'll be part of a spike that runs 1.5. Then you'll have another pullback. But he's staircasing, bleeding out. That Ponzi, it's like the game. Everybody suddenly realized the post. And the key thing that so few people say, March 2020, the big game that you and I will not mention, but everybody knows, was the end of the game for bulls. Nobody said it. And I stood through 2.5 years of people saying, buy bonds, wear diamonds, on Twitter to me every time I was saying, you want to be short this. This is a permanent turn. The 40-year was my first ever call on the debt market cycle has turned. And it truly has. It has, and it's happened. And I still think there's people that haven't realized it yet, but more and more people now accept it. It's no longer edgy and properly out there to be saying that. 2.5 years ago, it properly was in the 20s when everyone was still in the masking and the injectables and all the other nonsense.
No, Francis, absolutely. I waited to make that call about the bond market until I got a yearly reversal signal on the U.S. 10-year, right? On the U.S. 10-year yield. I was waiting. I wanted that 50-year bull market of the U.S. 10-year to finally throw a one bar. The way I do it, a one bar reversal where we close above the high of the last bar in the previous trend, right?
Yeah.
That's my definition of a reversal signal, just for everybody, for the technical traders in the audience. And it happened, and I went, we're done. This is going to run from here. Powell's got everything it set in motion. The ECB is behind the curve. They've got $14 trillion worth of negative yielding debt at the time. They're done. And it's just a matter of watching this play out. And eventually, I then said, when Kuroda widened yield curve control to 0.5% before he left, I said, the Bank of Japan is now getting set to change the name of the game. They're the last ones overtly doing yield curve control. And they're going to slowly, by degrees, exit that. They're going to have to. Ueda knows what the game is.
If we get contagion, Tom.
Put in place to do exactly this, Francis, because Kuroda's right-hand man, Kishida, turned the job down, saying, I was the architect of the old policy, and I'm probably not the man to run the new policy Japan is going to need. Now, in a seniority-based culture like Japan, for him to say that was the biggest freaking tell of all time. And I'm like, oh, and then Ueda comes in, mealy-mouths the markets for a few months, and now we're in that process. And I expect the Bank of Japan to continue to come in and defend the yen between 150 and 152 versus the dollar, and they'll come in and they'll bomb it. I have a patron who is a 40-year market veteran and is Japanese. And he's like, shorting the Bank of Japan against the Bank of Japan is the widowmaker trade. So many people have tried it and so many people have failed. The Bank of Japan knows what they're doing. They're not morons. They're in trouble, but they're not morons. And he says that at any one moment in time, they got $100 billion worth of U.S. dollars in liquid cash sitting on their balance sheet. They will use it and they will deploy it to defend the yen when they need to. And anybody who doesn't believe me, go look at the charts, go look at the history, and you'll see what happens. So I actually think that the BOJ at this point is actually acting like the Fed's wingman. I've always thought that, but now I really think that. And
he is his wingman. If you listen to Professor Werner, we did an interview with Professor Werner, who was, Princes of the Yen.
Yeah, Princes of the Yen.
Yeah, and, you know, he makes it quite clear, both Germany and Japan were treated quite differently, funny enough, post-war, and that essentially the BOJ is a sub-branch of the Fed. You know, it is controlled through the Fed. And they get told, you have a savings problem. They got told a while ago in the late 70s, you have a savings problem. This was during the period that they were manufacturing too much stuff, exporting too much to the US, and not buying much American goods. And they got explained to them that they had a savings problem and that they need to deal with that. And then they did the pumpermentals where they were phoning everybody aggressively and offering them more money to buy property, etc. And they created the entire hyper debt financialization event that led to the 80s, 90s blow off, where the Emperor's Palace was worth more than Manhattan, etc., etc. The Nikkei through to 40, and then the subsequent loss, not one decade, but three or four decades, only now to be reversed. We're very bullish the Nikkei on a weak yen, where there's clear exporters that are yen hedges, where people will still be buying Toyotas and Hondas and various other high-quality Japanese items. So it's quite ironic. But I literally stayed the entire 20 years in the UK, and there was a Money Week author called Meryn Summers at Weird, and I used to read her. And every year she started the year saying, this is the year the Nikkei goes up. And she did it for a decade and a half. And she didn't get it right, unfortunately, once. And I felt like sending her a letter and saying, you now can say, you know, that thing you've been saying in an ironic tweet. But it's a bit mean. She's a good analyst generally, but she never got that one. But she kept thinking.
I am also long the Nikkei. There's a good ETF for that, DXJ, which is also, it's a currency hedged version, and as opposed to buying,
that's the one you want, you see.
Yeah. DXJ is the one you want.
Basically, you want the international corporations. And so this is what bugged me, because I listened to, our big hero, what's his name? Soros's ex-partner, who was in, not Jim Rogers. I like Jim Rogers, forgotten the guy's name again. He's still in Wall Street. It'll come back to me in a second. The guys are screaming in the comments when we release this. Anyway, I'll get his name again. But he was saying, this is the most difficult year and the most difficult market. And I was going, what? The debts market's reversed. The Japanese are at 0.25, going to 0.5. And the yen is being crushed. You've got to be short the yen. You've got to be long the big Nikkei industrials with huge export markets. What am I missing with that trade? And we continue to see exactly everything come around, and the Nikkei, and now suddenly everybody's again waking up to the Nikkei, because they were the most extreme example that doesn't have the exorbitant privilege of currency control.
Mm.
And they were the first as well. And they took it the furthest as well in terms of low rates for the longest and kept stacking it. And they monetized and rebought half of their own markets in there. And they don't have international support for it either. And they've got a terrible demographics curve like this, which is only surpassed by the South Koreans. So, yeah, it was a fascinating chat. So Japan is interesting. And many of us don't talk about Japan because we kind of think it's, we think we understand Europe and America, and we just forget. And it's such an interesting set of circumstances there, and it has to be exploited.
Now, you can also just look at it in the other kind of case, looking at the Japanese market, which is that Mrs. Watanabe wants to keep her money in Japan, and it's the Bank of Japan's job to manage that. And for as long as they were able to create small positive real yields relative to inflation, the average Japanese investor would stay in Japan, and that's a cultural thing. And so that's what they're facing now. And so, you know, Ueda is going to have to, you know, run interest rates up pretty quickly here. And you'll note, we're now looking at 87 basis points today on the Japanese 10-year with the yen right below 150. We'll be at greater than 1% before the end of the year. Ueda will have to move the yield curve limit out probably at the December meeting. Okay. And he'll do it slowly in order, because I think the CPI came in at 1.7% this month, or 3.2%, which is a real problem for them, that they have to get back to 3%. And if they don't do it quickly, they're going to be in serious trouble. They're going to lose the confidence of the Japanese investors, who are then going to start looking overseas for yield. And where are they going to look? They're going to look in the U.S.
Or Singapore or Indonesia, or, you know, emerging markets. They could even go, you know, the multiples on the Brazilian markets are very low. They could go commodities. I don't know. It depends on what their investment thesis is. Once they're out of Japan, they're out of Japan.
I'll say this just as a point. in preparation for this interview this morning, I wasn't sure where we were going to go. I actually looked at the Singaporean yield curve, and it's a mess. It is deeply, deeply inverted. It is a, it's a downward slope all the way out to 50 years. There's not even a, there's not even a hump in it. So the MAS, the Monetary Authority of Singapore, has a problem because they're desperately trying to hold the Singapore dollar below $1.40. And, you know, and so they have, they've destroyed their yield curve. So don't get me wrong, I'm a big fan of Singapore, but at this moment in time, because of the way they're positioned geopolitically, but at this point in time, the MAS has a real problem with a yield curve as in, as deeply inverted as it is. And the long end of their curve is at 3% when the Fed's at, you know, 5%. So again,
that was not the only country in that situation. I just think from a capital formation point of view, I see them emerging a lot more as London and Europe tapers as a result of what's probably coming, and potentially America too.
Let's say out of the debt market since Singapore. That's all.
Yeah. And that's going to be very supportive. But what you said about the debt markets is spot on. I also see the Middle East becoming a capital formation hub. The ambition always seems to follow the tallest tower and the silly money chasing, you know, what I'd call vanity projects. We, of course, got the Burj Al Arab in, you know, Dubai. We now got Ronaldo and all of these, you know, almost past it, but big name football stars being bought for obscene amounts to try buy themselves a Premier League status. And you could just get the feeling that, it kind of was like the Eiffel Tower, and then it was, you know, that it was every major nation first declares itself that way. And that's how money seems to flow around. And the vanity projects, whilst they're really very good commercial sense, they do tend to be flag bearers of where money is reaccumulating and being employed.
That's a really good point.
Yeah. And I can see that. On the reset side, Tom, surely now if we're going through, we want to trade this cascade of cards in the manner that it's falling and in the order as best as possible that it potentially could be falling. So we see this, we see Jay Powell out front on this 1500 meter run and he's leading the peloton. And slowly, I think, rather than being a traditional 1500 race where there's a lot of guys at the back that finish with a kick, what ends up happening is that the peloton slowly withers and peters off behind. Starting with a couple of emerging markets that have dollar-based debt, the weakest in the hand. What's actually shocked me that is that we've actually got this far so far, and nothing's broken officially yet that we know of. Let me say it like that, because I suspect many things are broken, but there might be a bit of the Fed might actually be doing a bit of supportive duct taping even to prevent those things from breaking so that they could get deeper, higher up. I don't know whether they would actually want that to happen. The economic hitman saw us end up with small nation states with highly expensive infrastructure put in by Halliburton, et al., and all the contractor feeder sucker fish to the big shark that pick up all that money and then have dollar-denominated debt. And now they find themselves unable to print dollars, of course. And as these rates go higher, their interest payments should be going up unless they had very well negotiated fixed rate deals that weren't rolled into something else. And the demand for dollars is actually dropping. I mentioned this. So I was with Tom Palisades. You mentioned that you'd spoken with Tom. Mm-hmm. In Zimbabwe, they are taking without any knowledge, and it's a standard rule, if you are paid in USD, in Zimbabwe, the people actively tell me, don't send me a bank ETF. Give me notes if you have. If you send a US dollar payment to a Zimbabwean in Zimbabwe, the government automatically freezes it, takes 25%, and then releases a 75% amount. This is how that country is dealing with its dollar shortage. It's literally a confiscation tax on the basis that we need this more than you.
Yeah, no, that's crazy.
I do feel that is sort of oil to the wheel of those that of Brent Johnson and against those that are hypercritical of him. I don't think, you know, he's got the timing. He's not a technician, but in terms of principles of the mechanisms, I think he's been his explanation pretty accurate. So if this happens, we should actually have a cascade, not only of debt crises, but of potential Forex reserve crises with major wild swings in the foreign currency markets to come. The currency markets could become like crypto markets in a semi sense, because we're so used to, we're thinking, you know, oh, 5% to 10% move like we've had here. I mean, we've actually got a forecast of the Korean won halving on a macro technical setup against.
I haven't looked at Korea at all. What I'll say is this: just look at what's happened to Turkey and the lira.
Yeah.
Right. That's there. There's a market that has broken, and you could argue, and part of it is because they have massive U.S. dollar denominated corporate debt relative to their issues. It's been going on. The devaluation of the lira has been going on for 5 years now, but the Turks, because they are geopolitically so important to both Russia and China and everybody else in the region, Erdogan is getting support from the Russians and the Chinese in other ways in order to de-dollarize their liabilities and to change their energy uses profile and everything else in order to get them the collateral they need to emerge from this on the other side with a stronger currency. And it's a process. And Turkey is going through the exact same thing in many ways that Russia went through post-2014, right? They had the same, we went after them with the same problem where Gazprom and Rosneft and others had tens of billions maturing in sovereign debt in a particular time period that was used to radically devalue the ruble. It didn't work. We didn't get, they tried to, the goal was political change, get rid of Putin, or in this case, get rid of Erdogan, but it didn't work. So, you know, there's going to be other, I haven't really been looking very closely at other emerging markets, but the thesis is sound that any country that still has significant dollar denominated debt out there against their foreign exchange reserves, they're the ones that are going to be most vulnerable to this, because the US dollar index is not going to stop at 110, folks. It's going to go to 125 or even overshoot and wind up at 150 if the system breaks. Okay, if the Fed does, but I don't know that the Fed is going to allow that to happen in one fell swoop. I think the Fed is actually trying to de-dollarize the world and do so in fits and starts in order to try and break as few things as possible, but still stay ahead of everyone. That's what
The way you get to a super high interest rate or a very high value on Dixie is it goes disorderly. In other words, there is, whether by intent or by, hey, we cocked up, or it's such a fine line to have walked and eventually we had to fall, you know, whatever narrative they'll spin, at some point it gets disorderly and there's a panic. And that's when you get essentially the British Soros trade, where they had to spike interest rates. They didn't have the money to defend the currency anymore. They threw it all in the fire and they burnt all the taxpayers' money. And then they had to push the rates. And then people were saying, who wants to buy a house on the dealing floor? You know, his interest rates had just gone to 15%, where before it was 5%. So everyone's payments. And I can't help but think in the reset dynamics of where they want to take us, you will own nothing and be happy. And one of the best ways of leveling the great middle upper classes that have emerged out of the Western capitalistic economies, which is essentially Commonwealth, Europe, Northern America, and Commonwealth captures the sort of Australia, New Zealand as well, right, is that they've all been synchronized leper colonies, because you've had to kiss the financialization of everything leper in all of them. So everybody is big-ass mortgage on the house, big-ass this, credit card. There's, you know, US has got $1 trillion on revolving credit at 21% interest. We've got all of those versions on student loans, cars, houses, any devaluing asset that could be financed, and a few ones that hold some value, and that they create a mega spike, and it's a flush out, and it's an intended flush out, and that only those that are not in debt and own things outright get to survive. And of course, on the flush out, hey, you can rent back your old house, you don't own it anymore, you cocked up, you couldn't pay your interest rates, hey, it was a financial freak event, and you know, your financial advisor didn't warn you, but you know, it is what it is. You didn't have the extra money and you couldn't pay when the rates changed. And a lot of people will say, oh, but I'm safe. I've got a fixed deal, or I've got this. And I'm going to say to them, you're as good as a lawyer's contract is ever good on something.
Mm-hmm.
And that maybe, you know,
no, maybe.
That's
great.
Maybe. until force majeure clauses are invoked and all sorts of things, you might find that it's not worth the paper it's written on. And so I actually encourage everyone to get out of debt, and that this is almost the nanothermite of a controlled demolition to your personal finances type.
I think that that is absolutely what certain players in this field want. I don't know that Powell wants that per se. What I really think is happening here is, because we haven't brought into the BRICS, we haven't brought into some of these emerging markets that are trying to de-dollarize their trade in order to effect the soft landing for them, right? By diversifying their foreign exchange reserves and by, you know, building up enough trade coming in other currencies that they can, you know, do debt, they can do currency swaps, they can rewrite, you know, these contracts. A lot like what happened with the Russian debt in the mid, like in 2015, where, yeah, they had dollar-denominated debt. The government, you know, they just reissued the things as ruble-denominated debt or euro-denominated debt or yuan-denominated debt. And then China gave Russia a loan and paid off the dollars and, you know, dealt with it and by opening up swap lines. And I think you're going to see a lot more of that, especially amongst the BRICS, and that's what they're trying to do now. And I think, honestly, Powell understands that the world is de-dollarizing because we can't maintain this. And he's actually trying to stop a dollar collapse. That the other, he's worried about a dollar collapse.
That's so his front running. Yeah.
Right. And so
he's got to keep the dollar firm. The problem is that
what he's doing now is he's creating he's creating heat sinks for hot U.S. treasuries that are sitting in foreign central bank balance sheets. He's trying to create domestic heat sinks for those, so that when they flow out, they immediately get absorbed by the American banking system, right? In some way, I'm starting to hear notes about changing the way the repo markets trade, and that there's going to have to be now going to be 100% collateral. There can't be any rehypothecation and whatnot. That's another way of creating demand for treasuries that hasn't been there before by changing basically margin requirements for clearing these trades. And so that's yet another part of the system, another part of this, so if you can fix the fiscal part on Capitol Hill, right? And then even just somewhat, and then create some heat sinks, to absorb some of this money flow that's going to happen as the dollar rises, then that changes, that avoids the worst of the...
But that money flow not going into debt, Tom, that's going to be the difference. Nobody knows where it should be. Yeah, so the money flow, and that's why I think the equities, even though they're down and are looking a bit soft, have held up as well as they had, because it's kind of, where else did you put it? You know,
Francis, I'm not making an argument for a bond bull market. What I'm arguing for is a gentler slope, a gentler upslope of rates than the catastrophic let everything, you know, explode. And I think
that's what anyone would try seek to engineer. I think the outcome you get is as a result of them clearly trying to engineer that, and that process getting out of control, though.
And I think that's why we have to watch the political situation on Capitol Hill and in Europe very carefully, because what everybody's trying to do now is say our political system is more stable than this guy. Europe is desperately trying to hold on to the idea that the European Union, Europe itself as a construct, the European project, is inevitable and is eternal, and that this, the U.S., that's a mess. When the reality is that the U.S. is going through a transition from basically committing ritualistic suicide with its fiscal and monetary policy. We have monetary policy that's starting to seem rational, and they still want to start four wars and run $3 trillion deficits, right? And that's why I literally say Joe Biden is a traitor, Janet Yellen is a traitor. These people are literally trying to destroy the U.S. and and freeze capital from flowing into the U.S. By creating this perception of clown world, when the reality is that we now have a hardcore fiscal conservative, the Speaker of the House, who understands that, yeah, we're going to have to support Israel because he's an evangelical Christian. That's the only way he can get you can get elected speaker, but that all the globalists just lost a major fight. And so I tend to like put this down to who's trying to implement what agenda. And again, who's trying to engineer this great reset? I don't think it's the Fed. I think it's forces outside the Fed trying to destroy the Fed. And if necessary, blame the Fed for everything that's going wrong and then subsume the Fed back into the Treasury. You listen to people like Elizabeth Warren really carefully, you'll see exactly them saying this. I've been saying for almost a year now that they're going to run, the Democrats are going to run on the idea that with a recession in the U.S., they're going to blame the Fed for it and run on the idea of getting rid of the Fed. The stupid libertarians will chime in because that's their raison d'etre, and subsume it and give all the power back to the Treasury so that we can have MMT. Because the only way they can do these grandiose plans of great resets is to, if the Fed's opposing them, then clearly they want to get rid of it or co-opt it in some way. And the ways they were trying to do it was to add new spending that no one wanted, and start wars that no one wants, that the Fed would then have to monetize. And that's what they want the Fed to do, is to continue to commit ritualistic suicide. And
I don't see that stopping. And in fact, the fact that it involves Israel now is the trump card. It's almost like fait accompli. America is entirely bound as lapdog to run into that fight, almost assuredly.
Now,
that's a great tragedy.
The problem for them is going to be the following. Every generation of Americans, younger than the boomers, don't care. And that's why this next election cycle is so very important here in the United States, because it could wind up being the revolution of the real great turning of the worm from a generational basis here in the United States, away from that we've been living with.
Seeing as you brought that up.
What's that?
Seeing as you brought that up, I don't have the same view, but let's hear your take. Sure. Who's going to win it? Is there even a chance that you get a real outcome given the previous events that aren't
mentioned? None of these things are, the probabilities of a good outcome are very poor. I agree. The most likely outcome is that we wind up with a hung election that leads to civil war or secession or whatever. And again, this is exactly playing into the role of the goals of these people that we've been talking about. Why? Because who guarantees the American debt if all the red states say, you know what, we're no longer part of the United States anymore? Who guarantees to that? Like who that? And you want a 15% interest rate on the U.S. 30-year? Well, Florida and Texas secede. And then what happens to the debt markets in the U.S.? This is the fulcrum on which all of this depends, that the United States stays together as a 50-state compact, implements hard fiscal discipline. And in this case, hey, let's go back to the 2018 budget, not even the 20, you know what I mean? And
this won't happen, though. That's the sad thing, Tom.
That's
very little things happen of that nature. I mean, we agree on many, many things, but the one thing that I certainly probably am different to you from all my study is that, unfortunately, the States was born in a masonry world from the Benjamin Franklin, Washington. That was essentially a handing over of the overt control of America when it was just the Virginia Company that later became the United States of America to a covertly controlled country. Mm-hmm. It never escaped the city of London and the Zio handlers there, and of course in Israel. And we're seeing perfect evidence of that all the time. And they want to run the whole bundled lot. They're not going to let little bits get a vote on it to leave. That is why I say secession just will never happen. It's our prayer. It's our hope. I'm sitting in the Western Cape here, and they would love to secede from Southern Africa, because they get bringing all the tourism, they contribute way more than they get back, they've got cleaner roads, less potholes. It's a Democrat party, Democratic Alliance party that runs it. It's the only state that isn't run by the ANC, you know, the man who came out the bush with the gun party. And, you know, so it just won't happen. But there's a movement, there's people, but it won't happen. They'll never get that vote because it's an unraveling.
You know, what's interesting, Francis, this is why I keep bringing up the difference between, like, LIBOR was the means by which the American banking system was beholden to the City of London, because it was a City of London set rate. And now we're on SOFR, and it's a different thing. And I really do think that the United States really didn't just declare independence. from that perspective, like, I think SOFR could easily be viewed as the real declaration of independence from the old City of London interests. I've come to this conclusion. And so I'm not disagreeing with you, right? What I'm saying is that, yes, the pernicious old European colonial powers have owned U.S. interests for a long, long time. And certainly the British vestiges of the British Empire have as well. The question now is whether or not the disposition of the pieces on the game board allow for a final change far away from that system. And I agree. I don't think anybody's going to do that willingly. I think they'll risk World War III. I think they'll risk nuclear war to stop it from happening. I put nothing past these people, nothing at all. And if the last 2.5 weeks since the attack by Hamas has taught us anything, it's this. So I'm absolutely scared to death about all of this, because that is my high probability scenario, right? But I want everybody to understand as well that there are paths out, and there are mechanisms, there are things we can do to avoid this. If we want, we can get into, well, how are you going to fix the fiscal problem? Well, we go down on the yield curve. We can do all sorts of things to balance the books. Like, there's ways of dealing with the problem but we have to get to the crisis point where we're staring at our own deaths and looking into the abyss before we're willing to make that moment. And I make that change. And I think that the fight over the speakership is an example of us staring into the abyss and going, yeah, that's not going to work. Because who allowed this thing to happen, Francis? Because Matt Gaetz wasn't even expecting to get rid of McCarthy, and yet he's gone, and we have this guy who no one expected to emerge from this process. So
I see very little solved at a political head change. I will say this, though, I'm far happier, where I do concur with you, is I'm far happier to have someone at least go about doing the right things in terms of the rate increases, then continue to add to the, so albeit long past the moment of turning. At least, you know, if the line is going to hit the iceberg, at least the fact that someone tries to start turning at some point, even albeit, as I say, it's probably a bit late. It's much better that I see the right actions taken. Politically, I'm completely jaded. I mean, they're all controlled. They're all going to, you know, you always get offered the new broom that's sweeping clean, and it's meet the new boss, same as the old boss, this just with a different personality, a different color tie. But that's you need never vote back. We're not going to vote back. We're not going to vote freedom.
I don't think voting out us into this mess is not going to get us out of it. Most of me believes that, and most of me sees a really bad outcome. But at the same time, I also see the entire reset process failing to take hold either. Because there's too many moving parts. There's just no way they're gonna engineer that. And I really don't think that that it's gonna go the way anybody expects it to. I think it's not gonna go the way you and I expect it to, or Jerome Powell, or Klaus Schwab, or George Soros, or the King of England, or anybody else. I think it's going to be a complete and utter mess. And because chaos, they're engendering chaos the world over, and they think they can control chaos. But by definition, chaos is not controllable. They have engendered a kind of entropy into the system that is not controllable. And they don't know what daughter reactions, as a chemist, I see it that way. And it just means
that it's an interesting view. I'll give you a counter view. Every revolution was controlled. They sold to the guys, the French Revolution. They sold to them purchasing all the wheat and destroying it to make the hunger, and then paying the people. That was funded, paying the hungry people to go and riot. In the same way, there were bricks on the street corner for BLM. You're talking about people that were doing this in the 1700s, the English Revolution, the French Revolution, the American Revolution, and the Moscow, the Bolshevik Revolution were all controlled and funded. In fact, many people don't know that American soldiers, because there was such a small Bolshevik force initially in Moscow, they were concerned of white Russians coming to fight the red Russians, the Bolsheviks, from other parts of the Moscow. And there were actually American soldiers along the Trans-Siberian line keeping rural people from getting involved in the mix until they had fully secured Moscow. And that's all funded by the same banks. So, you know, Warburg, et cetera, et cetera. So I think they will not do anything unless they're controlling it. That's how they've controlled everything this all the time. They won't set in process a chemical atomic reaction that they have no idea of how it's going to pan out. In that it's planned and rehearsed for the outcome that they have in mind. And I think, but in all that, so mine might be slightly more fatalistic, but I always hesitate to say not nihilistic. There are still things we do at the local level that absolutely matter inside of a much bigger narrative on that. And for people, especially when they're facing a PSYOP, there were a lot of people that got very, very mentally down as a result of the events of March 2020 and the 2 years. They got debt, they got damage, they got everything. It was a very lucky period for me, but it was also frustrating as well. My message to them is, you go prepare. And your 3 Gs is great. And that is pure practical advice, and applaud it. Gold guns. In fact, we owe ourselves a chart. We've been doing a lot of talking. And I'm gonna throw a curveball at you. I'm going to show you 2 charts. I'm going to start with the oil one, Tom. And let's share that. We get it back to something technical that you can comment on. So a small little, you know this all very well, but just for all the viewers, that was our collapse. Whoops, let's do that with a fatter Cokie again and do it in the transgender pink so everyone can see it. That was our huge subprime collapse of oil. So the interesting point that I'll make about that whole event is oil is like a tax, a skimming tax. Everybody was rich. Everybody's house was going up. Everybody was refiing on the house and buying a cabriolet. And during that period, all that purchasing tax, all that packaging, all that delivery, obviously, oil went up because of the demand, but also it was helped up to do an extra skim off of the excess wealth we all had. So that when it fell really hard. This was the first threat of war, 2014. We actually got on that short and it overperformed and it ran that low. And then this was the one we're famous for saying we'd get single digits and we actually got naught. And then since then, Tom, we've been back up. But we called recently, we called that top at 130, and then we said there's going to be a soft patch. It kind of came a little bit. We weren't 100% right on our energies. We said, watch out all energies, and we included uranium in that then. Uranium was held back, and then once oil turned, they all turned back up, and uranium was a runaway success. So we were kind of wrong on the uranium. We said it's going to be soft for a while. It was, but then it ran. And natural gas had the same. So the energies are kind of different. But funnily enough, at the moment, if we just look at this, where oil is now, just generally on this big monthly chart, how are you feeling broadly? As a commodity, you're bullish, I assume.
Yes, I'm bullish on oil for a variety of reasons, and not the least of which is that that I've been watching I think oil is the new gold. In that for years, if you argued that gold was being manipulated to the downside in order to, you know, prop up fiat currencies and the way gold traded classically, like the last gold bull market from 2002 to 2011, if you bought the New York Open and sold the New York Close, you lost 70% of your money over a historic bull market, right?
Yeah.
If you watch a weekly, if you go and you put up a weekly chart of oil, go put a weekly chart of oil up for this last year, Francis, you'll see what I'm talking about. And scrunch it down. You'll see. Look at these the first half of the year, and look at the amount of volatility and capping action that was happening below $86 a barrel on oil. Like the amount of any attempt by oil to break out, this was done geopolitically. This was when Biden was dumping the SPY on the market. And then eventually they also, this is WTI crude. I tend to look at Brent crude, generally speaking, because I don't really hold much stock in WTI. It follows Brent.
Okay, I can change it for you, but they do look very similar.
But in general, we have on, and Brent, we have a massive, because they were trying to limit the amount of money that the Russians were getting, right? So they were really
targeting Brent. There were forces that were dumping on oil because Biden wanted a lower inflation number. And there were forces that were actually looking to save the oil price. This gap came out of the Russian and Saudi production cuts.
Yes, absolutely. And so
rather than it being a globally consistent force, there were countervailing forces. Yeah.
Yeah, there were absolutely countervailing forces. And the other thing I always found really interesting, because I follow this so closely on a weekly basis, is that those production cut announcements or pronouncements from OPEC or anything that the Russians do or the Saudis do, they were all timed with moments where the, lack of a better term, were Biden and Yellen or Davos were trying to cap the price of oil, and then they would undo that. And every time that Powell did something that he wasn't supposed to do, i.e. by raising interest rates farther than he was supposed to, you watched Putin and MBS dovetail on this. So it was almost like they weren't coordinated, but they were riffing off of each. There was a kind of riffing off of each other. It's like jazz musicians trading.
Say that you're right. They could even have been cooperating.
They could have been, but they certainly weren't
when we went into the events of March 2020.
Oh, sure.
They printed a glut of it. Just an interesting point. This is actually short term. It's a slightly bearish structure for oil. And the one thing I want to point out is that if we get demand-destroying events, all be me a macro bull, all energies and common commodities generally, there will still be a repercussion on the consumption tax that is essentially oil, which is in the packaging and delivery. Whilst gold, as we are searching for the preservation of capital, getting money return rather than return of money, as you eloquently stated, is going to potentially have a higher role. And I was just interested to hear you talk about oil, maybe the new gold. And I was going to say, check him out, because I think we have, this might be interesting to you. I'm not looking to change your mind, just throw something at you. Let's just see if we can, divide them out. U.S. oil, we'll stay with a WTI contract just for now. Sure. And I'll just show you this more generally. This is kind of interesting for me, because one of the trades we put on in the pre-COVID event, this is a bit of a problem because it spiked. This chart you can't do because it went to naught. But you actually had a head and shoulder leading into the oil divided by gold chart. Now, I've done it the other way around. I've done gold divided by oil this time. So let me just get it on a better time frame. Let's just see how it looks. In fact, let me correct that. Let me just do oil, do it the other way around. U.S. oil, because it's confusing me a little bit. It's the whole world's gone upside down. I can't think.
Fair enough. Think it's done.
Here we go. This is the one I wanted to show you, because we could see it for this one. So this is sort of what happened, U.S. oil divided by gold. This is sort of what happened before we spilled into March 2020. Check this sort of technical structure like that, where that's a shoulder. You had a kind of very big head, and then you got another very low volatility, and this is why we trade the unvolatility funnel, and that we look for low volatility. You got a very low squeeze, you gave up the ghost. Now, because this is a regular scale, because I don't want that crazy the log scaling would just mess the chart up, but this was a huge trade. If you went long gold short oil, this was an unbelievable trade that paid you on both sides. And essentially, you took the dollar out of that. You could do $100,000 of gold, etc. It was a delta neutral trade. And I just thought it was particularly interesting that had a kind of head and shoulders just prior to the event. You could see that valuation. And then I was wondering to what extent, on a maybe a smaller or a lesser degree, we may start to get something a little bit similar. I haven't recreated the chart quite how I remembered it, but something a little bit similar in manner here. It's a little bit out of sync, and I think I've got the wrong contracts in. But if oil is starting to lose a little bit of ground, and we've got gold on the 2000 border and wanting to sniff a line, so you have to visualize this potentially going down. It's worth showing the gold chart now.
Well, again, so if you look at it from the weekly perspective, going back 4 weeks, in the way I look at it, the uptrend ended 4 weeks ago, and then we threw a one bar reversal. That big down bar, that big
thing,
we close below the low, and now we're just getting follow through action. So now the question is, where is it going back to? And I would start looking at the highs from April, the breakout level above that, and just and just draw a horizontal line. I don't do much in terms of lines on trend lines and whatnot. I usually just use horizontal support and resistance, and then read the bars, and if the bars are noisy at one time frame, I go out deeper in time to see what things look like. So if you go out a month onto the monthly chart to see what that looks like and see what we're going to throw for October and see if that translates through. See, so whereas the weekly chart shows you that we just scroll forward, giving you less data, what you see is that we had a bottom in oil versus gold 4 months ago, 5 months ago, a one bar reversal, a 4 month uptrend, and then there's no reversal signal yet this month in October.
So not yet.
As of right now, what we have is a reaction pullback off of the previous high, and we could be setting up either a range trade. Don't know yet. So what
interestingly drove this, we had the collapse in gold and silver that occurred, and then the immediate reversal and pump. They took us back. It felt like a final capitulation.
The low 70s, Francis. I just didn't buy for a moment that oil should have been trading in the low 70s, and no one else did. The minute that the Saudis and the Russians said, hey, we're going to restrict the supply of oil, we got a $20 pop in the price of oil. And, that's what I meant by oil is the new gold, that I meant in terms of volatility and suppression, right? That they've been ball washing the crap out of oil traders in order to get them out of the market so that they can move oil wherever they need to on a weekly basis. If you're constantly pushing oil on a weekly basis up and down 6-7% a week, right, relative to the price, then you're looking at that going, as a small spec trader, you can't trade that market. You get washed out every, you can't go into the weekend with a position in oil at all. And then because they can turn around and start a war on a Sunday or Saturday, they change policy or they do something. And so because of that, you have to just that's what I meant by that when I said oil is a new gold. So I think that, I don't know that oil is going to outperform gold here. It may, I don't really have a call on that. I just think that at this moment in time, if the oil markets are de-dollarizing, which they are, right, more and more oil trading is being settled in something other than dollars. Not all of it, but it's happening by degrees every day. The petrodollar is dying a death of 1,000 cuts. And there's an incentive for that for the emerging markets, for the BRICS nations, for, everyone. Well, then you're going to have to look at oil versus gold, because gold is going to wind up being the common denominator. Something that Vince Lanchi and I have been talking about is this very thing that, in effect, gold is going to be the de facto settlement currency for a lot of these, a lot of international trade, things out over the course of time. That's the real threat of what the BRICS are threatening to do. But they're years away from getting to that point because they don't have the infrastructure to do that yet. But they're building that infrastructure. They're building the gold vaults. They're building the exchanges. They're building the futures contracts and the mechanisms. And the other thing that I want people to really think about is that a lot of propaganda and a lot of talk, and some of it is justified, about China's property markets. Well, the Chinese are very good at, and have been doing this since the birth of the zero-bound interest rate regime, where everybody kind of, all the major non-Chinese central banks would do round-robin QE to lever everybody up to keep the credit assets from defaulting and deflating, right? So first the U.S., then the BOE, then the BOJ, then the ECB, or whatever order they did it in. The Chinese always, when it was the Fed's turn to tighten, relatively speaking, i.e. by ending QE, the Chinese would always go on an expansion. And they're doing that right now. The Fed has been tightening. The Chinese are doing Keynesian countercyclical liquidity injections is what they're doing now, in kind of a broadest sense of the term. And they're gonna let a lot of people go bankrupt, people who are not politically associated with Xi. Everybody else is going to get bailed out or nationalized. Xi told us what his plan was, which was, the shared prosperity platform that he put forth about 2.5 years ago. Everybody should read the bullet points on that carefully. And I know I wrote a big article about it then. I don't remember the title of it off the top of my head. That's the way we want to be looking at this at this point, because the Chinese are now looking to deepen their bond markets and make their, and if they want to do that and they want people to use the yuan, well, they have to have supply of, hedgeable assets for people to hedge their currency risk with, i.e. they have to have a dump for their profits, their yuan profits, and they got to put them in Chinese bonds. So they have to expand, they have to radically expand their money supply simply to do that very thing. While the dollar goes retrograde as the global reserve currency and becomes a regional reserve currency, the Chinese yuan has to rise as a regional.
That's up a little bit. Yeah, I've got something for you on that. In fact, I want to show it. But before I do that, I made a small mistake. Sorry, when I divided by XAU, it picked up some funny mining ETF. This is the chart I was looking to show you. Apologies.
Oh, wow.
This is the correct one to draw your technical conclusions. And then I'd already pre-annotated it for from prior work. This was the original head and shoulder that snapped. That was the original call of March 2020. My comment was, now, are we potentially doing something similar? And by the way, it's not. I'm not putting you as the guy that say buy oil over gold. You didn't say it.
Sure. I see. I'm just
more just a discussion.
Yeah. My problem, Francis, is that ages ago I dispensed with things like head and shoulders patterns. It's just not part of my technical purview anymore. But I see the
possibility.
The 2 week chart. Now this is a 2 week chart. So each bar, I'm seeing a bearish one bar engulfing reversal 3 weeks ago. And we're getting a bit of a correction, and we're probably going to go back to.
So the question just being,
I have a pattern in the short term, but what does that mean? I don't know.
Yeah. If we were to get a similar scenario, it's just a small possibility that maybe gold will be doing that well that even other commodities against it could be soft, particularly ones that rely on consumer demand if we get a crisis. That was
that's a very valid thesis, Francis. I would agree with that completely. And this is definitely
not forever.
And this is, and what I caution everybody to really think about is: do we get a monthly close on gold above $2,000? Right. That's the thing that if you just put up a monthly chart of XAU, right, not the futures market, but the cash, the Forex price of gold, which is what I use. And if you look at it, that we've never had a monthly close above $2,000. We've had spikes above $2,000. We've had a couple of weekly closes above $2,000, but never a monthly close. What I've learned over the years is that sometimes high closes are more important than breaking previous high, than closing above previous highs. Sometimes you got to get a high close, an all-time high close, to set up the real, that's your real impetus before you get the break of the all-time high.
I do actually have a feeling that we might be,
on goals of being long.
This is the time. This is my feeling, because it's three knockbacks, as you quite correctly said.
No less a technical analyst than Martin Armstrong has said the exact same thing, that this fourth attempt to break through 2000 definitively is likely going to be the case. Just invert that and think, is it going to be a breakdown? And and if they're capping the price of oil, and we're moving into the worst of the kind of stagflationary environment created by the Fed's high interest rates, then yeah, oil is gonna lose ground to gold. And then there will be a snapback trade.
Very positive for me for gold. The fact that the pullback is shorter. You had a very clear shooting star. It seems like you're a candlesticks guy. Very clear shooting star. Back to this point, previous shooting star over here, you pulled all the way back here. We had the dollar Dixie dominance that ran right to 114.
Yep.
Now we've already had a very strong dollar spell, and we're still going up and approaching the 2000 spell.
Exactly.
So now you think the dollar spell is going to reassert. This has been combined with some dollar strength, which is why I think we break it, we pull back, and then we're done with 2000. I think we move.
So, absolutely. I coined the phrase one day, but this is the way I do it. When I wanted to stick with my patrons, I do it. I do the George Patton thing. I do give it to them loud and dirty. Look at that, the current monthly bar. That's what I call a boner bar. The ball's just throwing a big boner. And it's just that's what you need to know. So as long as we close above 1950 on the spot price of gold this month to throw that monthly reversal signal, then we should get follow through into the end of the year. We could throw, and then that would then turn into a quarterly reversal and possibly even, of course, a breakout on the annual chart, right? It would propagate through time in such a way that there is no argument. It's a secular bull market in gold.
Yeah. Now let's take you to your China point. I want to show you something you might enjoy.
Sure.
Because we did a fundamental clip on why the Hong Kong dollar peg has to fail fundamentally. Wow. And we had a small technical setup. It wasn't too convincing. It was a small time frame, but it might have popped. So we thought, well, that's enough reason to get this fundamental clip out. And it was around about there, about a year ago. And we said, listen, if it doesn't break, it's going to get rebuffed for a while, and then it'll cycle back up. It got rebuffed a couple of times. But now we have, and you can see where the 7.85 peg is quite clearly. It looks like pubic hair candles there. with the number one shaver. And then this has formed a very large, and if you're into, I don't know if you like patterns for technical analysis or not, but this is forming a far larger, which by technical significance, bigger patterns are more significant, a larger squeeze for us. And we're in this moment. Now, you might go a touch lower, and then I think the next time we start running this third high, I think we're breaking this peg. And
I've been waiting for the Hong dollar peg to collapse. I don't believe in any currency pegs. I think they're all designed to collapse. I'm also wondering when the Saudis are going to break their peg to the dollar as well. That's a very big one. I've been waiting for that for years. What I've been trying to tell MBS as a side note is, hey man, when you decide to break the peg, do so when oil is at $100 a barrel, not when it's at 45.
Absolutely.
Do it preventatively and do it as a
You're doing strong. I think we've got a very interesting year ahead. That
is $100. I would argue that as well. Just from a macro perspective, I think that they've defended it twice. I don't know how much longer they can defend it. I will not be surprised when it breaks. It's going to break hard, just like all currency pegs. The same way that when the Swiss National Bank finally stopped supporting the euro, the peg broke from 120 and immediately ran to 104. Right. So,
It's very similar. It's very similar. So, in terms of that, we could have some great trades. This is the key thing. There's real wealth building opportunities for people that recognize there's going to be major structural coming apart, potentially disorderly markets that will take most people by surprise, will have generally poor knock-on effects on you, not very beneficial. But if you're actively well-positioned, correctly sized, and you have the means, these are the kind of things that could actually turn into rainmaker events, even though they could be fairly tragic in terms of that country's currency or this one's currency or that particular commodity getting more expensive, meaning inflation. You could find you get all your inflation paid for you and some all the way through into retirement and beyond. And that's the opportunity that still makes me excited and has me loving the markets, Tom. What is your I think there's a great chance of this, and this will be my home run trade or position.
For right now, I think that it's going to be a short of the euro. I just don't see the euro being able to hold even $1.06. I think that the euro is still, to me, the ultimate Ponzi scheme that has to come apart. And I don't, you know, with France losing control of sub-Saharan Africa, they've lost the peg. They've lost, you know, any undergirding of their economy. The Bundesbank and they're literally holding the euro together with spit and baling wire. Today, the euro is holding above $1.05 simply because the Swiss National Bank intervened today. If you look at the Swiss franc versus the euro, there was an intervention today. There was a slight intervention by the Bank of Japan. I've been saying for years that I think the euro is going to 60 cents. And I think that there's going to be a moment where there's going to be a moment where the tripod that is the European Union breaks, and it's Italy. And Italy is finally, you know, one of the things that's interesting geopolitically. And again, for me, this is, I look there first and then kind of drill in all the things we've talked about so far today. I agree with, I think they're all massive potential trades. I think, you know, the Nikkei going to new all-time highs. I think the Dow is going to outperform most other equity indices. The dollar is going to go to 125. It may be a purely euro-denominated event. It may not be a general, everybody loses against the dollar because the U.S., because remember, the DXY is mostly the euro. It's
52%. It's euro,
it's important to remember that it's mostly the euro, the pound, and the yen,
yes,
and not anything else. It's not
a lot of the problems with the euro, the pound has as well.
I think the pound is being used as a piggy bank to keep the euro alive. I'll be honest with you, because it's the Bank of England that's buying the most U.S. treasuries right now. The Bank of England's bought over $150 billion worth of treasuries in the last year.
Japan and England, because China is selling. This is why I say it goes back to who's the ownership. It's French and German and British Freemasonry, the City of London that owns Vanguard, that owns BlackRock, that owns the Fed, that owns, you know, all the banks that own the Fed. And in essence, they're the last guys that are holding up that genre. And as China retreats, somebody has to step in. And it should actually be the Fed. No nation state, no one acting in the interests of a nation state should be buying any debt instruments on behalf of its people as an investment. Especially right. When they're issuing their own at an unbelievable rate and can't put a bid under it.
Yeah.
Should they be going and buying some other nation's? But it is absolutely absurd that they are doing that. But that just shows that we're not dealing with a single nation state. We're dealing with a network.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. No, yeah. Agreed completely. So the big thing for me is going to be, you know, I think the pound goes to parity. I think the euro goes to 60 cents. I'm not saying for 2024, but in this part of the cycle, yeah. I think this is what happens.
Western currencies, these same grid and network. They basically, you're talking about Kissinger saying the money's going east, the gold's going east.
Yeah,
we are.
Gold is going east.
What you're saying is our network is going to rework through a different nation state's access to a larger degree and less through yours. Therefore,
yeah.
Wealth and economic activity in those regions will contract rapidly. And that entire middle, upper class echelons that have been set up on debt and many other things are going to have a real wealth lifestyle adjustment downwards. And there's going to be less open-ended, spend-a-thons where nobody has to account. It's going to be much more harder accounting, and you're going to have to fill the holes in your own road, as you were suggesting, which maybe not be such a bad thing because it might give you
something. And that is exactly what, I've done in my own neighborhood. I live back a private road in rural North Florida, but my access road, my private road was so bad, I just finally just said one day I took a monthly check from Newsmax and I threw it at the road. And I donated it to my neighborhood because my road needed to be fixed and someone had to step up and do it. And that was that. And I think that, you know, what I've been preaching to Americans is if you have investable capital, keep it as local as possible. If you can't find good valuations in equity markets or this or that or anything else, there's, you know, your local banks need the, they, you can, one of the things I've mentioned is like multiple times. And this is a simple thing. You can get 5.5% or 5.3 or 4% on a 3 month treasury bill, right? Well, you open up a treasury direct account, the money goes directly to the government, blah, 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 blah. You could also buy a 5% 7 month CD from your local credit union, your local bank, and forego 60 basis points in order to make sure that they have enough working capital to keep your local economy flowing. And you give up 60 basis points, but that your investable capital winds up locally being lent out to.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, what a great idea.
The money doesn't need to go to the Fed. It doesn't need to go to BlackRock. It doesn't need to go to Vanguard for them to manage. Go buy the month special over at your local credit union and give up 60 basis points and let your bank have that 60 basis points to repair its balance sheet.
100%. 100%. Tom, it's been absolutely phenomenal and a great chat as always. Thank you for what is more than a normal time allocation. Yeah. Guys are going to love it and enjoy it. For people that wish to engage and hear more about the three G's, the three godly G's, I would almost say, from gold, goats, and guns, how else should they go about finding it?
So you can follow me on my blog at tomluongo.me or goldgoatsandguns.com. You can follow me on Twitter at TFL1728, and you can sign up for the Patreon at patreon.com/goldgoatsandguns, where I do talks like this twice a week with charting analysis and general commentary on every Wednesday and every Sunday, as well as we do a monthly retail investor-focused portfolio-style newsletter to give people a kind of, you know, give retail investors, you know, distill all this stuff down to the basics while I explain all the high-level stuff. Oh, by the way, buy this company and buy this theme or get rid of that theme. And we do it on purpose that way in order to try and, you know, gradually move people up the path of understanding how these markets interact in the way they do, because it's a lot and there's a lot going on. And we don't do trading advice. You know, I don't do trading advice, though I will do some positioning for people. I also do bespoke chart reads for people. You send me a ticker and I'll look at it. I'll even do a cursory look at the balance sheet and see what I have to say about it. So we try to give people as much value as possible for as little money as possible, because that is the goal, ultimately. Yeah.
Great team. Love it. Tom Luongo, thank you again for your time. Have a great one. And see you on the other side. Maybe come on your channel if it's appetite for that. Look forward to it. And thank you for your time.
Thank you, Francis, for the invite. You be well and you have a great weekend.